I'd like to address it to Eric Gustafson. I know that Kofi Annan does not have another Sergio Melo to, if I've got the name right, to send, but I really think it's important for the United Nations to play a crucial role in between us leaving and the attainment of a more viable government, you know, active government in Iraq. That we have no right to be there, but we also have no right to leave a terrible vacuum and all of the, with all of the problems that we've helped to create to make things worse.
I think you're absolutely right. The UN should play a greater role and has greater legitimacy in playing that kind of a role. Sergio de Mello played a crucial role in finding Iraqi leaders who were not expatriates to serve on the Iraqi Governing Council. Almost all of the non-expatriates that were the results of Sergio de Mello's efforts. And it is a tragic loss that he is no longer with us today. However, I remember very clearly, Dennis Kucinich, I know the Congressional Office, I know them very well, and I feel like they were presenting a non-option. I think it's important to differentiate between what's ideal and what's possible. And I felt that they were presenting the ideal as though it's possible, and it's not possible at this time. And I think that that kind of goes directly to more of the change that needs to be happening. Finally, very quickly, one of the challenges I find in doing this kind of work right now is because the Bush administration never prepared the American public for what would happen with the aftermath, never prepared the American public with what would be required to leave a stable, more democratic Iraq behind. And so I am always on the receiving end because I'm a realist and I'm going to tell you exactly what I see as being required. And unfortunately, while the U.S. doesn't have any business being in Iraq, we do have a responsibility to the Iraqi people. So it's determining how to leave Iraq without leaving chaos and a vacuum, power vacuum behind.
What I'm going to do to have equity is that I'm going to, if there's a question, I'm going to give at least one person on the opposite side a chance to respond for 1 minute. So.
Yeah, just really quickly, I don't think we should be looking to replace one occupation with another form of occupation. And I don't think that the United States will allow the United Nations, and the U.S. is still the predominant power within the framework of the United Nations, will not allow the United Nations to set up anything that's in opposition to what U.S. interests are in Iraq and in the region. Plus, we have to take account of the history of what the United Nations has done and has been in Iraq. The sanctions, the brutal sanctions, which claim more than 500,000 lives in Iraq, conservatively, just looking at the impact on children under five, were United Nations sanctions. I don't think the UN is an independent, neutral body in this situation. If it is brought in, it will be brought in because the United States wants to shift the burden of occupation onto the United Nations. I don't think that is the solution that we're looking for.
A quick question to Alex, and then a question to either of the gentlemen flanking the table. To Alex, how did your fellow troops react when your commanding officer said, it's not about anything idealistic, it's about oil? And the question to either of the gentlemen, especially the one on my far right, I'm sorry I forgot your name. You know, I'm someone who was very much opposed to going in, but now I find myself sort of wobbling between your two positions. And one thing I would like clarified is how much is absolutely set in stone. You alluded to it, and then it wasn't challenged by Eric, as to corporate control, oil being controlled in a certain way. These are things that the American public were led to believe were up for grabs once the Iraqi legislature got into gear. But you alluded to certain things that are absolutely set in stone, and I'm wondering if this should be challenged.
Well, first I'd like to correct you real quick. Our first sergeant was the one that told us that we'd be going there for oil. And the way he put it to us that he was not a pessimist, he was a realist. Our commanding officer would never tell us anything like that. Just sort of give you, an idea of the difference between officers and enlisted men. And as far as the reactions, the guys that had not been in the unit too long, not been in the Marine Corps too long, were kind of taken back by this because these were obviously not the official reasons. This is not what was being told to them on the news. Guys like myself, Michael Hoffman, that had been there for a while, just really shrugged and said it figures, because we knew our government took part in underhanded things, and it was just a matter of time before we were somehow included in them.
It's actually funny because when I deployed with the 864th Engineer Battalion with the 91 war, we were told it was about oil as well. And I might add that the war that I took part in, the 91 Gulf War, was the second Gulf War. Don't forget that. That was the second Gulf War. The most recent war is the third war that Iraq has, a major, serious war that Iraq and the Iraqi people have had to endure recently. The so-called Bremer decrees, I don't pay a whole lot of attention to them because I know that almost a lot, not all of them, but I think a lot of the Bremer decrees are going to be undone, because now that there's an elected transitional government, the transitional government will begin to examine a lot of those decrees. But there are going to be issues in Iraqi politics, and there's corruption, and there's major challenges. So there still needs to be an effort to make sure that we don't see the U.S. doesn't continue to provide assistance and then completely ignore rampant corruption that might be happening, and not just with U.S. dollars, but with Iraqi oil revenue as well. $20.9 billion has been allocated to Iraq reconstruction. $13.4 billion has been obligated. Only about $5 billion has actually been spent. So you can see a lot of it still has to be spent. And these corporations, these big prime contractors, they're having to depend on Iraqi subcontractors to be able to get the work done.
The government that's being formed in Iraq is reliant on the U.S. occupation for security, reliant on the U.S. occupation for political support, is more accountable to the U.S. than it is to the Iraqi people at the moment. Now, the situation is such that the United States is obviously intervening to determine outcomes favorable to its interests, which means access to oil, access to markets, neoliberalism, creating an example in Iraq of the kind of regimes it wants in the region. It's not going to let go of those goals lightly. Does that mean that every single thing it wants it will get? No, because there will be resistance on the ground. There's a struggle in Iraq, but if we want to see opportunities for the Iraqi people to control their own resources, institutions, the fundamental distorting fact is the U.S. occupation, and that's what we have to challenge.
Well, Eric, Epic, the election that was held was not the election Bush wanted to call. It was the election that Ali Sistani wanted to call, so we wound up doing what he wanted. And it seems to me that the U.S. forces now, Ali Sistani does not, they do not like us, but they do not want us to leave right now before they have the situation under control. So it seems to me the U.S. force in there right now is Ali Sistani's security force. And furthermore, can you see any configuration of events in which a government in Iraq would ask us to leave? And can you see that we could do anything other but than to leave if it's so requested?
Those are excellent, excellent questions. One of the challenges with the elected transitional government, as I alluded to earlier, is that not all of Iraq's 18 provinces are adequately represented. That's something that EPIC spoke about prior to the elections, and we continue to speak about it. So there needs to be more of an effort to include those other provinces, especially Nineveh province, because it's a very important province. It's got the city of Mosul, one of the larger cities in Iraq, in that province. But the big difference here, it's not just Sistani, and you're correct. Grand Ayatollah Sistani has played a crucial role, and it's not the other clerical establishment in Najaf and Karbala. The mass rallies, the mass demonstrations, where you had hundreds of thousands turn out in the streets of Baghdad and Basra, that's part of why suddenly the timetable changed. And it wasn't caucuses, it's we moved towards elections. But there was also pressure by Sistani and others to for the transitional government to appoint a government, and we're seeing that accelerate. But finally, last point, The transitional government was elected and is now, as a result, more accountable to Iraqis rather than Paul Bremer, who had appointed the previous government. And that's the big shift, and that's, I think, going to start to drive a lot of the change.
It's only been a couple months since the elections, and I guess it would be too early to tell if the newly elected government is making any kind of difference. But really, until all U.S. forces, all occupying forces are removed from Iraq, the government cannot actually begin to take hold and control the Iraqi people as far as reestablishing security, reestablishing stability. Really, as long as U.S. troops are present, any kind of government can be put into place, but the violence and the killing on both sides is still going to continue. The Iraqi people do not respect the occupation, and a good number of Iraqi people feel that the current government is somehow either controlled or somehow really kept in place by the U.S. occupation. As long as these kind of attitudes are maintained by the Iraqi people, the majority of Iraqi people will not fully trust the government that's in place.
I actually agree with that.
I
agree with that.
Okay. But
that's a very good point.
I think that all of the speakers, and I think most of the people in the audience, agree on one thing. That's how American forces, the American government should get out of Iraq as soon as possible without all hell breaking loose. I think there's agreement on that. However, there are two fundamental questions that maybe the panel has skirted. One fundamental question is, how do we get the American government to do this? And maybe more basic than that is, what should the American government do to get out? And how do we get the American government to do this?
We're going to have to compel the United States to get out over the immense interest that it has in Iraq, which is going to involve, I think, civil disobedience, building a broad anti-war movement, involving soldiers and their families, having soldiers themselves organizing against it, and understanding that the Iraqi people are going to continue to resist this occupation and have a legitimate right to resist this occupation. And so that there'll have to be, like there was in Vietnam, a fight to force the U.S. government to do something that it absolutely does not want to do. And in terms of all hell breaking loose, we have to remember every colonial, every imperial power has used that argument to justify its continued rule, its continued occupation. It's what the British said in India. It's what the Belgian and French said in Africa. I think we have to reject the logic that it's the U.S.'s role to preserve stability and prevent civil war in Iraq, when in fact the United States has no history of having the interests of the Iraqi people in its decision-making apparatus whatsoever.
We've seen an interesting shift in terms of the rhetoric, and the question is whether it will translate to actual practice with this administration. And that is from what we saw in the 1980s and previously. And this is part of the reason why the United States has real work cut out for it, to be able to build trust in the region and elsewhere in the world. We shifted from backing Saddam Hussein and other tyrants and ignoring human rights abuses to now, at least in the rhetoric, supporting, promoting democratic change. We have yet to even begin to create all of the changes necessary for the United States and our policies to be a true force of good and to truly promote that kind of change. But to be able to do it, you have to support the good guys in Washington. We have to build the institutions to create a change in the political culture. And we also not only need a lot of Americans to work on the outside, agitating, protesting, which I strongly support, but we also need to support those who are bringing the policy change from within.
Hey, I had a question for for Eric, I was wondering how do you think that the elections are actually a step in bringing Iraqi independence? Because I know like the vast majority of Iraqis that, you know, that did vote, like, didn't actually know who they were voting for. It's more that only something like 7% of registered voters actually knew who the candidates were. And plus, I mean, in order for the actual candidates to participate in the election, they had to be willing to work with the U.S. occupation. And also, the U.S. Like specifically broke up the electorate into along like, you know, ethnic and sectarian lines. And I mean, none of the individual, you know, religious or ethnic groups have any majority. And the U.S. has been like pretty explicitly trying to exacerbate the differences between them. And also, it like if you remember in the run up to the election, the U.S. Ran their massive campaign against Fallujah, and I mean, you know, their whole logic was for this was, you know, it was in order to prepare the country for the elections, and I mean, it was just absolutely devastating. Something like a good 65% of the buildings in Fallujah were completely brought to the ground, and there's no running water, no electricity. I mean, at least tens of thousands of people are refugees now. I mean, I've actually heard reports that they were using napalm. I mean, there were actually, you know, journalists got in and saw U.S. forces throwing, like, dozens of like, bodies into, that were just, you know, completely charred black into mass graves. I mean, I don't see how actually, you know, like, this actually comes, you know, a good year and a half after, you know, Bush's whole, you know, stunt on the aircraft carrier saying, you know, the war is over. I mean, now we're bringing stability. I mean, if we're using this kind of barbarity and stability, I don't see how the U.S. could actually possibly bring democracy.
I agree with your sentiment. I do. A few quick things. One, a lot of it had to do with the timetable, and it wasn't just the U.S., but the U.N. also played a role. The U.N. Electoral Division also played a role in terms of defining the process. We opposed it. EPIC opposed how it was done, because the entire country of Iraq was treated as though it was one single voting district. And there's a number of other issues involved, and we believe that it should have been in terms of the 18 provinces and making sure that all 18 provinces, regardless of voter turnout, was equally adequately or proportionately represented in the new government. That hasn't happened. However, there are steps being made by a lot of the leadership to be able to reach out and draw in representatives, like Nineveh, as I mentioned. Ghazi al-Yawar is actually a tribal leader from that area and is strongly supported from people in Mosul. Not everybody, but a number of people in Mosul. So there's opportunities, but I agree with you. It's not. I'm not here to defend the Bush administration. I'm here to talk about real changes that have happened and that we need to continue to promote and support in order to lead to an end to the occupation.
Now, considering the fact that Iraq, you know, is and continues to be a war zone, you can't expect to have an election like, you know, type would have here, where people calmly walk down to the polls, vote, and go back, you know, go about their business. But the fact that a lot, you know, most candidates could not even appear on, you know, their pictures could not appear on posters for fear of being killed. The fact that, you know, a lot of the people voting did not even know who they were voting for as a result of this. So this election did not go anywhere near what a typical election should be. But to have this election, then to say that it's a step in the right direction is, you know, it's completely false. The point needs to be realized that this election was done more, I mean, this is, in my opinion, more as a show to, you know, to the people of the U.S. and the rest of the world that we're doing something, when really it's just an excuse to try to legitimize the occupation.
Yes.
Yeah, this is a comment and a question for Eric. I find it astounding that on the one hand, you're willing to lend your support to an occupation of 150,000 troops with howitzers and stealth bombers and God knows what else. And on the other hand, you condemn the Iraqi resistance as people resorting to violent means to change things. I mean, how do you square that circle? I'd like to hear how you can actually justify the violence of the world's largest superpower on the one hand, and on the other hand, condemn people for standing up and fighting back against occupiers in their land. That's the first thing. The second is, you know, when you talk about Abu Ghraib being a failure, I think the only way in which Abu Ghraib was a failure for the administration was that the administration let the news leak out into the media. That's where they failed. Otherwise, in terms of what a colonial occupation looks like, go back and look at any occupation in history. Look at Vietnam, look at India, look at Algeria, look at Africa. Torture is standard. That's part of the standard operating procedure of colonial occupations. That's how you crush a resistance. That's how you humiliate a people. That's how you establish the idea that these people are not human beings. And we, the white people of the world, are going to tell them how to run their society. And unless we know who's going to run their society once we get out, we're not going to get out. But because who knows? Who knows what's going to happen? I think what you're arguing here is comes straight out of late 19th century classic imperialist white man's burden argument. And I find it absolutely insulting that you would say that and at the same time claim to be against the war. I don't see how you can square these circles.
Having served in the military, I know all about psychological operations. I know about establishing the in-group and establishing the out-group, and so I guess I'm part of the out-group, according to you. I'm willing to have a dialogue, and I think that this discussion is worth it. That's why I was willing to come here without getting what I normally get in terms of an honorarium. And I'll do it again, because I think that this discussion is crucial. In answer to your question, if you listen to what I had said earlier, I talked about how politicized Iraq continues to be under sanctions and now under occupation, and how violence, am I going to justify violence that targets civilians? No. Whether it's coming from the United States or whether it's coming from terrorist groups or insurgents, when it deliberately targets civilians, I'm not going to defend it. And that is the vision, that is the dark vision that could occur if things get worse in Iraq. So I'm looking at how, as I said earlier, you look at four provinces and areas in four provinces, you have serious violence. And occasionally you have terrorist attacks that go on in other places, including in some of the shrine cities. But you look at the other provinces and you don't see widespread chaos and disaster. And a lot of that is to the credit of the Iraqis themselves. But currently, in terms of central government and the governing institutions, the Iraqi people, the Iraqis do not sufficiently have a means to provide for the security of the government and the security of the civilian population. That is the reality. We can walk away and act as though everything's going to become all nice, but actually things will turn to chaos. And unfortunately, Americans will cease to care, because if American soldiers aren't there, you know, we'll turn the television station to something else. That would be the worst case disaster, because reparations, I mean, again, I deal with the possible. I'm not going to deal with non-options. And right now we have to deal with the only responsible way out of Iraq, and that's providing capacity building and providing real assistance so that we don't see chaos when U.S. forces leave.
Let me just break in. I think that we have to actually probably be out of here by about 10. Am I correct about that? 10, so maybe we'll stretch it to 10:05. So give us another 10 minutes. You know, obviously there are a lot of people who want to speak, but I actually think people, you know, many, many good points are being raised, and I hope everybody's understanding of the constraints. But I do understand that there's a student here, one of the students from City College is here, who is one of the students that's been charged and who did want to say something. Am I right, David?
Not quite, but we do have at least some good news. The student charges, the charges against the students apparently were dropped today. That does not mean the struggle is over. Elizabeth, you want to say a couple of questions?
We thought it was. Everything was fine now. Okay.
Yeah, I just wanted to let everyone know, since the hearing that was scheduled to be on Friday was announced, that actually just today the charges from the school against the three students were dropped. That's because of an incredible campaign that they organized with solidarity from the PSC and a lot of other allies. The staff member who was arrested, Carol Lang, is still going to have a hearing, I think, in the next week or two, that obviously is going to require a lot of solidarity to get her charges dropped, and all of them still face criminal charges. So there's still an ongoing campaign, but this is an incredible victory for them. Yeah, the police charges against them are outstanding. They were arraigned on Wednesday. And I'm a member of the Campus Anti-War Network that's involved in the struggle. And if people want more information about it, I'd be happy to talk to you afterwards.
Okay. I think just to give up, we have 10 more minutes of really an important discussion. And I really feel like everybody, is sincerely trying to figure out what's the right position, and I think it's a real important conversation to have. And, but in the interest of speed, I'm going to ask each of the speakers to take no more than 1 minute, and I'm only going to have one person from up here respond, if that's okay. So you should address your comment to whoever it is. Go.
Okay, timing. Okay. My name is Anita Cole. I am a veteran. I was in for 4 years as an interrogator before I was honorably discharged in 2002 as a conscientious objector. A couple of weeks ago, I had the opportunity to hear Alex very candidly speak about the post-traumatic stress disorder that's affecting so many other soldiers, and how he also spoke about the fact we're giving a whole country PTSD. And I wonder, as an active duty soldier, and Alex is an active duty Marine, I wonder if it's perhaps not exactly in line with the work of an engineer, that we cannot, as soldiers, we don't learn conflict negotiation. We don't learn how to resolve things peacefully. We learn how to, resolve at the other end of an M16 or at the other end of a howitzer. So what does our presence there do to support capacity building? I now work in nonprofits, and so I really don't see how my nonprofit work would benefit by having armed soldiers around. Finally, in answer to what people can do, I would definitely recommend supporting organizations, because it's a huge step for soldiers, sailors, Marines, airmen to come out against this war. Support them in their transition. Let them know that it's going to be okay. Support organizations like the GI Rights Hotline, which gets calls all the time from people making that reconnection with our humanity, and organizations like Iraq Veterans Against the War.
Right, definitely. That's something I definitely meant to touch upon, the post-traumatic stress disorder. The fact is, for those of you who don't know what it is, it's just brought about by anything from car accident, violent crime, disasters, both natural and man-made, and combat. As far as, U.S. troops receiving post-traumatic stress disorder, it's just from, killing, witnessing killing, just the fact, myself, I did not actually get into ambushes or, open fire with my M16, but the fact that we killed, very close to, our battalion killed very close to 1,000 Iraqis with artillery fire, that has had a great impact on me. And in terms of, you mentioned giving a whole country post-traumatic stress disorder, that is the way the human body will react. For example, family of Iraqis is sleeping, and a bomb gets dropped in their house, and one of the kids survives. That kid is not going to deal very well, considering that his family has been wiped out next to him during the night, things like that.
Next speaker, we really do have to wrap this up because we have a changing of security guard in the building. We don't want to inconvenience that person. Yes.
Okay. My name is Mike Gold. I've been a member of Vietnam Veterans of War Against the War since 1970. I have a question for Eric and Alex, who's veterans. What do you think about the attack of the administration and the Congress against the Veterans Administration? That they want to close 18 hospitals, they want to double the drug fee, they want to provide a yearly co-payment toward veterans with non-service-connected disabilities, and the VA budget's about $3 to $4 billion short. The head of the House Veterans Affairs Committee wants to change the definition of veteran to only those that have been combat wounded or service-connected disabled. And there's a conference on June 15th at the Hunter School of Social Work on PTSD.
I think I'm just going to give one of you an opportunity to respond to that.
Yes, as far as cuts to the VA, President Bush, you know, has no problem going in the air and saying, I support the troops, and, you know, just over Easter, he said that, you know, pretty much sent his prayers over to the troops that he coincidentally sent over to Iraq, you know. And behind our backs, he goes and cuts hundreds of million dollars from the VA. That is not supporting the troops, no matter who you are. And the fact is that, you know, a lot of people don't know, they're already homeless Iraq war veterans from this current conflict. There have been countless suicides, and there, for example, Marine Reservist Lance Corporal Lucy actually slipped through the cracks of the VA system, and his dad ended up coming home and finding him, hanging from the rafters from a garden hose. These are very serious problems that definitely do need to be addressed, and really within the same realm of bringing the troops home and taking care of them when they get here.
We have to hasten the day that U.S. forces safely come home. Already, 1.1 million Americans have served in Afghanistan and Iraq. Out of those 1.1 million, I believe somewhere around 60,000 have filed disability claims with the Veterans Health Administration, and about over 10,000 have visited veteran centers in terms of receiving counseling. Post-traumatic stress disorder, we're looking at somewhere around 1 out of 4, 1 out of 5 returning soldiers. When PTSD goes untreated, it leads to suicide, it can lead to domestic abuse, it can lead to violence, it can lead to homelessness, joblessness, alcoholism, drug addiction. We're talking about a serious issue that we haven't even begun to grapple with as a society.
I'm being given a very significant signal that if we stay another minute, we're really inconveniencing the security guard. I'd like to just say two quick things. One, this is a very important discussion. Those of you who are interested in continuing it or want to set up other discussions in your neighborhood or in your home, please call Parents for Peace and let us know. We'll try to do what we can to help facilitate whatever kind of discussion you think would be useful. Again, I want to encourage everybody, you know, to work with us. Many of you are working with us or with another peace organization. Our efforts are really urgently needed. I especially would like to ask all of you to join me in thanking Alex, Anthony, and Eric for coming here this evening and participating in a really difficult thing. So we really appreciate your being here, and we really appreciate seeing all of you here as well. So good night, and I hope we'll meet again.